everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Spellman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. It's a delight to have you with me today, as always, so we can have a very fascinating and in-depth conversation about topics that are really relevant for your health, your hormones, your well-being. You know, unless you are truly informed, you cannot make the best decisions possible regarding your health. So that's what this program is all about, enlightening you with truthful information. And from there, you have a better idea of what you need to go and where you need to go to really achieve optimal results. And as always, I just want to remind everyone, I have a fantastic website called What Women Must Know, and this is a great place to go. If you opt in, you'll get several of my special reports. I have many of my published articles on all aspects of hormonal health and well-being. There's some videos up there. You actually will get my radio shows emailed to you. And you might as well go over and like me at What Women Must Know on Facebook, because I do daily postings of great information, strategies, healthy recipes, breaking news, just the kind of information that really makes a difference for you and your loved ones. So go in over to the Facebook page and like me there, and just keep getting more and more empowered with that kind of information. Not sure what's going on in the background there. Sounds like someone's throwing dishes. I also want to just say that I will actually be in New York City on May 11th. I venture into the Big Apple twice a year, and this year it will be Saturday, May 11th, 2 to 5 p.m., and that will be at the Natural Gourmet Institute. This is a one-day seminar. Actually, it's an afternoon seminar that is called Hormone Myths, Hormone Truths, and this is the place to be if you really want to get to the root cause of what's going on with your health, your hormones, really find the best strategies, solutions, practical guidance to really make a difference with how your hormones are functioning, how your health is functioning. It's a power-packed 3-hour event that actually will change your life. So come along, check it out at the Natural Gourmet Institute. The class is small and intimate, so you'll always get your particular needs and questions answered. And I just love to meet as many of you as possible. So if you are in the New York metropolitan area, or if you know someone who's in that area, this is the place to be. And it's quite an enlightening experience. I trust that you will be profoundly changed by what you will learn and the practical steps you will also discover to get you where you want to be, to greater health and well-being. So that's it. May 11th, Saturday before Mother's Day, I will be back in the Big Apple. Can't wait. And today, let's have a fantastic discussion today about a topic that is just so profound. Many of you are aware of terms such as insulin. You might have heard of the term called leptin. You may have never heard of the term called mTOR. But these are really critical concepts that play a major role in our health, in how we age, how we manage our weight, risk factors for all the chronic illnesses. And even though you may have been familiar with some of these terms, most people don't really understand what's going on and why these issues are critical to understand and, most importantly, to manage and balance our lives so we can really heal and rejuvenate our bodies. So today we're going to be giving you the insider's tour of what is happening with our hormones, with our insulin levels, with leptin, with obesity, with diabetes, and an anti-aging strategy that protects us from chronic illness. Sounds interesting? I hope so, because it's one of my favorite topics. And as my guide into this fascinating world, and actually one of the leading experts in the field of insulin, leptin, metabolic syndrome, is Dr. Ron Rosedale. And Dr. Rosedale will be with us today. A little bit about Dr. Rosedale. Dr. Ron Rosedale is an internationally known expert in nutritional and metabolic medicine. His interest in metabolic medicine began as a student at Northwestern University Medical School, where he worked with Dr. Jeremiah Stamler, who is one of the world's experts in the epidemiology of diet, cholesterol, and heart disease. Dr. Rosedale has been a pioneer in applying concepts based on the biology of aging to reversing diabetes and heart disease using a nutritional approach that he has developed to improve the cellular response to insulin, leptin, and mTOR. He has published a highly acclaimed book, The Rosedale Diet, and his success has been featured in many magazine and newspaper articles and in dozens of radio and television interviews. For the last two decades, he has lectured worldwide, including keynote presentations in Russia, Belgium, Brazil, Germany, and India. One lecture in particular, Insulin and Its Metabolic Effects, given many years ago, has achieved worldwide acclaim. He has consistently been, as Dr. Joe McCullough has said, 10 years ahead of the curve. And we are so lucky to have him today with us. So hello, Dr. Rosedale.
Well, hello. It's a pleasure being here. And we had a great time at the cancer conference, and I'm glad to contact or have connection with you again.
Yeah, you know, just so my listeners know that I was part of a conference 2 weeks ago called Best Answer for Cancer held in Dallas, and it was a fascinating conference with some of the leading practitioners in the field of integrative medicine, particularly looking at many of the factors that influence cancer, and that's where I met Dr. Rosedale. We had a great time together. He's a wild dancer, I can tell everybody, and it was just such a pleasure to meet him in person because I have heard of your book. I have heard of you, Dr. Rosedale, for many years, but never had the pleasure to meet you in person. And even better, I've never had the pleasure to have you on the radio show. So here we are fulfilling all these great desires and dreams of mine. And I know you have such important information to share. Your lecture was actually quite riveting at the conference, and I thought it was really a topic that would be very relevant for my listeners to understand. So as we know, this whole condition called metabolic syndrome and these terms, leptin and insulin, are thrown around all the time, but I just don't think people really understand them as they should. So I thought we need to go right to the expert, and that's you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So how should we begin? Where should we jump in with this topic?
Well, let's perhaps discuss, as you just mentioned, the relevance and the importance of these hormones. What I've said for many decades, in fact, many years, is that one can kind of distill most health and medical knowledge into a single sentence, and that is that one's health and longevity is going to be mostly dependent on the proportion of fat versus sugar that they burn over a lifetime. Let me go into that statement a little bit further. The body has essentially, the cells in the body and the tissues in the body have two choices for fuel. It can burn sugar, glucose, or it can burn fatty acids or ketones, which are metabolic byproducts of fatty acid metabolism. And that's the two choices. And when you look at it from many different angles, it's far healthier to burn fatty acids and ketones than it is glucose. And the reason we have glucose really is as an emergency fuel. You can burn it without oxygen. And so glucose is there as a secondary anaerobic fuel, and for those few tissues in the body, such as red blood cells, that have to burn glucose and can't burn fatty acids, in the case of red blood cells, because they don't have mitochondria. So when we're just talking right now and relatively relaxing and not exercising extremely hard, when we're not sprinting and running away from a lion or fighting in battle, 90% at least of our cells should be burning fatty acids or ketones. But instead, we are forcing our cells to burn glucose because of mostly our diet and because of improper hormonal signaling, and especially the metabolic hormones. And whether one burns fat or sugar is going to be determined 100% on signals from particular hormones that regulate this metabolism. And these hormones are mostly the hormones that will regulate metabolism and that regulate whether you can burn sugar or fat, and regulate the connection between energy utilization and cellular reproduction, essentially eating and reproduction, which are the two main biological prerogatives, are going to be insulin, leptin, and mTOR. And so that places these hormones, among all the hormones, to me at the very top of the list. I mean, they're the generals, because everything follows their orders, because we can't do anything without energy. And so you've got these metabolic hormones that essentially are the generals that give orders to thyroid and estrogen and progesterone, insulin, glucose, will all determine what's being done in the body, and it will determine your health.
Can you define leptin? Because I don't think that enough people really understand what leptin is and why it's such a major hormone that really affects how our body functions, how we burn fat or store it. So maybe we need to just define a little bit about leptin.
Yeah, leptin is a really critical hormone, and if I had to name one chemical in the body that's the most important for health and longevity, would probably be leptin. Leptin is a hormone that is produced by fat itself and can be produced by some other tissues, mostly in fat. And what it's supposed to do, if it's working properly and if a person is healthy, is tell your brain, in particular the hypothalamus in your brain, which is kind of the central switchboard that controls everything in the body, controls every other hormone, and the nervous system, and it tells the hypothalamus how much energy is available for use. And that's critical, because in our ancestral history, the amount of available energy determined whether cells would reproduce or not. It made no sense to even try and reproduce, try for a cell to divide if there wasn't enough energy available. And it turns out, in the last 15 years or so, we've discovered a metabolic pathway, you might call it, or several genetic pathways that are upregulated. You might call it the genetic expression of longevity. So if there isn't enough available resources, if there isn't enough available food, it appears that virtually all life has methods of outlasting the famine. It upregulates DNA repair, it upregulates intracellular antioxidant systems, what are called heat shock proteins, all the different, and something called autophagy, I should mention, because it's very important, it's kind of cellular housekeeping. And cleansing, garbage collection. These are tricks that nature has had that are extremely ancient, goes back to the ancient oceans when life was first developing, that allowed life to outlive a famine. And we can use these tricks on a consistent basis if we know why they're there and what regulates them, so that we don't have to undergo a famine, we don't have to undergo calorie restriction, such that we can continue to increase this genetic expression of longevity and therefore reduction in the chronic diseases of aging by regulating the hormones that mediate that genetic expression of longevity and health. And those hormones, again, are going to be insulin, leptin, and mTOR. So that's what's so critical. And leptin, since our major energy source, we store fat. We don't store much sugar. Our major energy source is supposed to be fat. And leptin, then, is a kind of the top of the chain that tells the rest of the body what to do with that energy, essentially, whether to live a very long post-reproductive lifespan or essentially not, if the message isn't getting through properly. Now, to explain it a little bit more specifically, leptin was first discovered, I think, in 1994 in a mouse strain called the Obi mouse that was very fat and was used as a model for obesity and diabetic experiments. But they didn't know why it was fat. And Dr. Friedman at Rockefeller University discovered that the reason this mouse was fat was because it lacked a hormone that nobody had previously known existed, called leptin. And when he injected this mouse with leptin, we purified some leptin, it became thin very quickly, a few weeks, and non-diabetic. And this made headlines all over the world. Every major newspaper in the world carried front page headline, "The cure for obesity was found." Well, not so quick, because it was subsequently found that people who are fat, not even obese, but just fat, didn't have this same mutation in the mouse strain. In fact, if you measure their leptin, it wasn't too low, as in this mouse. It was almost always high. And what was discovered then, it was a different process, same hormone that was critical, but it wasn't because of a lack of the hormone, it was because of hormonal resistance. You had the hormone, you've got plenty of leptin, even too much, but it's not getting through to the brain to tell the brain that you're too fat. So if you're healthy, what's supposed to happen is that as you start becoming too fat, which is in our ancestral history would have been a death sentence, because if there's a saber-toothed tiger running after a group of people, it's going to catch the fat one, one that couldn't run so fast, so that the tiger wouldn't have to run so fast and exert too much energy. Animals by nature are lazy. And we'd get the most bang for its exercise buck. So it'd get a nice fatty meal, a lot of dense energy without having to work too hard. But for the person who was fat, it's an unfortunate ending. So nature knows that in our ancestral history, it would not have been advantageous to be fat. Also, it would impair our ability to hunt and gather. So if we start getting fat, it sends signals to the brain that you're getting too fat, your life is in danger, that you need to stop eating so much, and you need to expend more of this fatty energy. And the hormone that tells the brain that you're getting too fat is leptin, if it gets through. And so as you get more fat, you produce more leptin. It goes to the hypothalamus in the brain. It says you're getting too fat, and nature knows that the only way it's going to make you eat less is if it regulates your hunger. There is no way in the long term that you can consciously fight hunger. If you're hungry, you're going to eat. And so leptin, one of the major effects of leptin is to appease hunger. It satiates. So as your leptin goes up, it tells your hypothalamus, arcuate nucleus in the hypothalamus, that you should not be hungry, you shouldn't eat so much, and in fact you should burn off excess fat. And that is what you'll do. Unconsciously. You don't even have to think about it. These are signals that arose long before we ever really had these type of thoughts. We just did. A lot of these signals occurred, insulin and mTOR especially, in even single-cell organisms where they didn't have a brain. So these are really, really ancient signals. Now, leptin has many other effects, but we'll just stick with this one. Leptin controls reproduction. You can't even initiate menstrual periods as a young teenager unless leptin is sufficient. And women marathon runners, for instance, who have a very low fat percentage, their leptin levels actually are too low to initiate ovulation. So leptin integrates reproduction and energy availability. So how much fat a person has stored is extremely important, and the major hormone that tells all the other hormones what to do as far as obesity and fat storage and energy use is going to be leptin. The problems arise, however, if we count on leptin too much. Just like in diabetes, in type 2 diabetes, what happens there, for instance, is we eat a diet that constantly raises our glucose, eat starches day in and day out, several times a day, causes big spikes in glucose, which causes insulin to be spiked several times a day, and pretty soon cells become desensitized to the action of insulin, called insulin resistance. Kind of like being in a smelly room for a long time, pretty soon you can't smell it. Same way, virtually the same mechanism even, that the cells that are overexposed to insulin day in and day out, even from times in utero, if your mother was eating a high carbohydrate diet that turned to sugar that caused her insulin to spike, it would transcend the placenta and cause the fetus to already become more insulin resistant by the time the baby is born. And so that predisposes that baby then to diabetes in the future even. And in fact, if that baby is a female, they found that the eggs of that baby will be more insulin resistant, therefore the mother affecting the risk of diabetes in her grandchildren. Now, is this genetic? Not really. It's genetic expression, which is really much more important. It's which genes are being read and which ones are being shut down. That's what determines your health. And that's what these metabolic hormones do. They affect genetic expression, which genes are allowed to express themselves and which ones are allowed or are being forced to be quiet. And so it takes the same genes, and you can have totally different so-called phenotype of health or phenotype of disease. And the same thing happens with leptin. If you eat a diet, we know that there are foods, certain types of food. Again, we know that glucose and even some amino acids will cause leptin to spike. And can have a baseline leptin level from the amount of fat that you have, but if you eat a particular diet, mostly a diet, again, that's high in carbohydrates, very similar to what affects insulin, it will cause leptin also to go much higher in that same day. Previously, in fact, many experts today who even know anything about leptin still believe that leptin is only affected by how much fat you have. That's absolutely not true. Absolutely not true. And I found this out myself when I started measuring leptin probably 15 years ago, right after it was first discovered. I measured it in all of my patients, sent to a single lab, the only lab testing it in the U.S., which was really just being done for experimental purposes, and found that I could lower leptin in one day by changing their diet. And that was really very, very new news, because at that time it was only thought that leptin was affected by quantity of fat. And I showed that it wasn't quantity of fat, it was type of diet that a person ate that could vastly affect daily leptin levels. And if you eat a diet that promotes higher leptin levels, again, it's like being in a smelly room. Pretty soon your cells, and especially the cells in your hypothalamus, cells in your brain, can't hear leptin. And what it hears then is a very low signal. And it behaves as if you have a low leptin level, even though you have a high leptin level. Now here you're getting a real disconnect between the body and the brain. So your brain is hearing that you've got a low leptin level, even though you've got a high leptin level, which is getting dangerous. In other words, you're getting fat, and your brain thinks you're too skinny. And because you've got a low leptin in our ancestral history, that meant that we didn't have enough fat to store for a forthcoming famine. And we came from a history of feast and famine. And of course, if we didn't have enough stored energy and we encountered a famine, those people would be the most likely to die first. And so that was at least as important as as being too fat. So when you have leptin levels that are too low, it's telling your brain that you don't have enough fat to survive a famine, that you need to be hungry, you need to eat more, you need to store more fat, and critically, you need to not burn the fat that you've got. That's what a low leptin level would typically signal. However, here what's happening when you have leptin resistance is that you have a low leptin level, or you're hearing a low leptin level, even though you are producing a lot of leptin, and if you were to measure the leptin in the blood serum, you'd see that it was high, not low, but your brain thinks it's low. So even though you're fat, you're going to maintain your hunger, you're going to eat more, and you're going to retain the fat that you've got. You won't be able to burn it. And that's how people get fat. Almost everybody in the world who's fat goes through that scenario. They're fat because they are leptin resistant.
So I just want to jump in here. So the more we are holding excess weight, the more our fat cells are making leptin, and the more leptin that's flooding our body is now creating our brain to kind of get tone deaf to it. So it's always assuming it's not there because it doesn't get the signals from it. It's kind of into how we say it's like it's so much of it's going on, it turns it off. And therefore, we keep feeling hungry and wanting to eat more because we don't get the message. Is that right?
That's correct. And it's worsened. It's augmented. In fact, even, I think, caused by surges in leptin on a daily basis from the type of food that we eat. So leptin is not just controlled by how much fat we have, which was typically thought. And they thought the only way to get leptin lower was to become less fat, but the only way to become less fat is to get leptin lower, so you're into this quandary. But I found that that's not true. You can lower leptin a great deal without even changing the fat percentage initially, just by changing one's diet to one that is far less sugar producing and not overly high in carbohydrates. And the importance of leptin cannot be stressed enough. PCOS, that's leptin, multiple sclerosis. There's a lot of research being done at Harvard and other universities on leptin's link to multiple sclerosis, because it's found that there's a big surge in leptin prior to the onset of MS, and that if you control leptin, you can both reduce the incidence of MS and even treat MS extremely effectively, far more effectively than any of the drugs that are out for MS right now. Osteoporosis, big issue in women. There's a huge connection between leptin and osteoblastic activity. Now, for the audience that hasn't heard that term, your bones typically go through what's called a remodeling, and that's where you have osteoclasts that are there specifically to break down your bone. And that's extremely important. We need to break down bone on a consistent basis so that we can replace old, dry, brittle bone with new, more flexible bone. And that's how your bones can stay strong. They have to be flexible. It's a nice young tree that can bend that will withstand a hurricane. The old, dry, brittle trees are the ones that will break. The way that osteoporosis right now is typically being treated is to reduce osteoclastic activity. That's not the right way to treat it. In fact, it's very unhealthy. So you're getting all these problems with all the drugs that are being used for osteoporosis, because by just inhibiting osteoclastic activity, by inhibiting the breakdown of bone, all that gives you is thicker, drier, more brittle bone. That if you break them, and they have almost as high a chance of breaking, they shatter like glass. Almost impossible to, very difficult to heal properly. Whereas you don't get these green stick fractures that you might have gotten when you were young, where you really don't have to do anything and they'll heal on their own. So they might look good on a bone density test, but bone density and bone mineralization really has nothing to do with bone strength. That has to do more with the flexibility and the protein content of the bone. Absolutely nothing to do with calcium. And I wrote several articles, several of which are on my website, that talks about the relationship between calcium and bone strength. and basically almost a negative correlation. The more calcium you take, the weaker your bones will be. It goes against everything you've heard. Now we're kind of going off on a different subject, but I'm bringing the subject up because leptin is critical in the manufacture of bone, not just the breakdown. One of the few hormones we know that actually stimulates osteoblastic activity, and those are the cells that actually build the protein matrix of the bone and make them stronger and more flexible. And that's what women need to do to maintain bone strength and reduce fracture risk as they age.
I'm just going to jump in here because it's time for us to take a short station break. And then when we get back, we can talk more about leptin, insulin, and this other hormone that I just learned about from your lecture, mTOR, and the importance of these hormones in preventing chronic disease and aging. So good stuff. Everyone, hang in there. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know with my special guest today, Dr. Ron Rosedale. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know, and we're really, really fortunate today to have international best-selling author, lecturer, and researcher right there on the leading edge, Dr. Ron Rosedale, who is the author of The Rosedale Diet and one of the leading experts on the whole issue of metabolic syndrome and all the factors that drive obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and most importantly, what we need to do to really reverse the aging process, one of my favorite topics. So, Dr. Rosedale, this is so interesting, the whole discussion on leptin, because to be honest, I had no idea, and I'm sure most people do not really understand how this hormone, leptin, which is made from fat cells, has such a profound and regulating influence on so many functions and systems of the body. So you talked about osteoporosis, you talked about MS. Is there anything else that we really need to know about what leptin is also affecting and influencing?
One other real critical system is the glucose insulin system. Actually, they found that by giving leptin to strict type 1 diabetic mice, they can totally control their blood sugar. In other words, these are mice that produce no insulin. So there's a very profound effect on blood glucose, and we found now in type 2 diabetics on insulin release by the hormone leptin. Fully half of your blood sugar on a daily basis is there because your liver is manufacturing it, so-called gluconeogenesis. And gluconeogenesis is glucose is produced in the liver, and the liver is getting signals from the nervous system, primarily the sympathetic nervous system, which emanates also from the hypothalamus. And so leptin, by controlling the hypothalamus, controls output via the vagus nerve, which influences a great deal how much sugar the liver produces, which very much affects diabetes and is a huge player in that too. So really there are no chronic diseases. Cancer is also very influenced by leptin because of its effect on regulating cellular division. So we know that leptin and this other hormone that fewer people even know about, mTOR, stands for mammalian targeted rapamycin, are also highly connected. So we can talk about that and its relationship and mTOR's relationship to cancer. One question, though, I will answer before anybody asks it, that if they haven't stated it, they're thinking it in their heads. Why isn't this information known? If it's so important, why haven't they heard about it from their doctor? Why isn't their doctor testing some of these things? And the reason for that is because there are no drugs that affect these right now. It's very difficult. They've been trying to, they tried to give, when leptin was first discovered, for instance, it was really, really hot. Every drug company in the world was trying to be one of the first to manufacture leptin so that they could give it to the billions of fat people and make trillions of dollars, until they found that the problem wasn't too little leptin, it was actually too much leptin and leptin resistance. And even to this day, they haven't been able to treat insulin resistance with a drug. They've come out with so-called insulin sensitizers, but they weren't. And now they're having to take them off the market. And those are the so-called PPAR agonists. Started with Revulin and then Avandia and now Actos. Right? They're all history for the most part because of adverse side effects, because they didn't do what the drug companies said they did. But there are no drugs to improve leptin sensitivity. It's very difficult, much more difficult to improve the orchestration of hormonal signaling than just raising it and lowering it, you know, just as a blanket. The way the body works, it is an orchestra. You have to have higher signals in some places and lower signals somewhere else. It has to be heard properly. It's not just a matter of having a signal or not having a signal, having cholesterol or getting rid of cholesterol. That will never get you anywhere as far as health. In fact, it will almost always impair your health, make you much less healthy, more unhealthy when you treat health that way. But that's unfortunately the state of our medical system right now. That's where it's at. And that's why we're running into so much trouble. And that's why you really have to go beyond that and listen to shows like Cheryl's show. Because patients are going to have to educate themselves, because where the doctors are getting their education is from the pharmaceutical industry, and their motives are not to, to improve your health. Their motives are to maximize profit, and the two are counter to one another. You don't make money off of a healthy person, and that's why we're running into so much trouble.
Let me jump in here. Can I ask you a question? Is the
sure.
driving issue, and kind of then becomes an effect in its own, but is the driving issue that creates this insulin leptin resistance, the obesity epidemic, is that what drives the leptin to be overproduced and therefore, you know, that tone deaf effect by the hypothalamus? Is that where the problem starts?
Well, I think it's a vicious cycle. So as one gets more obese, then they produce more leptin, and then the hypothalamus can get more toned up, just like you're saying. But I think what really drives it, because otherwise it would self-regulate, what really drives it is the current popular diet of that the medical profession has been telling people to eat, a high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet. The carbohydrates turn to glucose, and whenever glucose goes up and it raises insulin, it causes leptin to also spike on a daily basis.
That correlation.
That big surge in leptin from diet, I believe, is what really drives the resistance to its signal, the tone deafness.
So it goes back to obesity is just the symptom of consuming a high carbohydrate diet that our cultures around the world are now doing.
Correct. And that's a major problem. So we're starting to really see the effects of that really ill-conceived recommendation that we ought to be on a high-carbohydrate diet, because that's what people are eating, and people are addicted to it now. And for the first time in the history of mankind, we're seeing a reduction in lifespan of mankind. Lifespan has consistently been increasing and increasing, and now we're starting to see a downturn. That's brand new, and it can be totally attributed to the diet that the world is eating, and that's very, very unfortunate. And we should also make sure that we mention that when we say what people should be eating is a low-carbohydrate diet, well, there's not all low-carbohydrate diets are the same. Since we've been bred almost to believe that fat is going to kill us, and that if you eat fat, it's going to plug up the pipes in our arteries and we're going to immediately die of a heart attack, that is not true. That is absolutely not true. That's not how heart disease works. It's not how we get heart attacks. It's not because we're eating fat that's plugging up our arteries. It just absolutely doesn't even remotely work that way. That's just a picture that drug companies have painted so that people will buy cholesterol-lowering drugs. It just doesn't work that way. It works as an inflammatory process, and we know also, I should mention, you mentioned important aspects of leptin. Leptin itself is very, very pro-inflammatory, one of the most pro-inflammatory chemicals we've got in the body. So as leptin levels are high, it increases the state of inflammation. As we eat high-carbohydrate diets, the glucose that flips around and is transported in the bloodstream glycates the lining of the artery. Basically, it just sticks to the collagen of the lining of the artery, which is very pro-inflammatory. That inflammation is what then causes plaque to build up and plaques to rupture and blood to clot too readily, and that's how you get a heart attack. Absolutely zero to do with cholesterol, which is they're really trying to repair the damage. So it's associated with heart disease. It's not causing it. And leptin is very much involved in that. But all low-carbohydrate diets are not the same. Because we've been so brainwashed into believing that fat is a killer, what has happened is that when people are adopting a very low-carbohydrate diet, they immediately go to a high-protein diet. So low-carbohydrate and high-protein is what has been connected. But that's not the way to go either. And this is kind of the segue into mTOR, because we know that the mammalian target of rapamycin is a metabolic pathway. It's not a hormone as such. But it regulates the genes, regulates genetic expression through this metabolic pathway that senses amino acid availability, i.e. protein availability. And the two major nutrients that were required for cells to divide in the ancient oceans were glucose and amino acids. You needed glucose as fuel, and you needed amino acids as building blocks for cells to make more of themselves. And when glucose and amino acids were high, it was a signal for cells to rapidly divide. And insulin was a signal for glucose availability. mTOR, mammalian target of rapamycin, is the signal for amino acid availability. And when both of those are high, cells divide and divide and divide. And in today's language, we're talking cancer. So when we constantly have signals elicited by glucose and high amino acids mediated through insulin and mTOR, we greatly increase our risk of cancer. And we have to keep those low. So if you're going to adopt a very low-carbohydrate diet, you don't want to eat too excess protein because it'll stimulate mTOR too much and increase your risk of cancer, what is left? Well, there's only three major macronutrients. You've got carbohydrates, protein, and fat. And oddly enough, fat is the only macronutrient that is sort of, to some extent and a great extent, actually risk-free, because it doesn't raise insulin, and it doesn't raise leptin, and it doesn't raise mTOR. And there's reasons for that that I brought out in the cancer conference, having to do with the way that life evolved, that life evolved in an anaerobic environment. There wasn't oxygen in the atmosphere. And you cannot burn fat without oxygen. So fat wasn't used as a fuel when all these signaling systems were being developed, and the relationship between fuel availability and lifespan and cell division were evolving, happened prior to fat being used as a fuel. So now we can burn fat without having really to worry too much. So the same nutrient that we've been told to be absolutely scared of, that has been made into the Darth Vader of health, actually turns out to be our best friend. That the best diet to actually reverse obesity and reverse diabetes and heart disease and reduce risk of cancer and even treat cancer is a very high fat, very moderate to low protein, and very low non-fiber carbohydrate diet.
So what kind of oils do you recommend? I mean, because we talk about fats, there's so many toxic oils out there. We just need to really be specific. So
more specific, exactly. Yeah. To me, that's where 90% of nutrition lies. The evidence that implicates non-fiber carbohydrates is extremely high. So we can go back a bit further and just talk about what to eat, which actually boils down to very simple principles. There's only three major macronutrients, as I mentioned. There's protein, fat, and carbohydrate. Let's start with carbohydrate. Carbohydrate is either a fiber or not a fiber. That's how you should divide it. Whether it be simple or complex is really irrelevant. Whether a carbohydrate is fiber or not fiber has huge repercussions. If a carbohydrate is fiber, it doesn't turn to sugar. That's why it's beneficial. It's beneficial mostly because it's not detrimental. It doesn't turn to glucose. Any carbohydrate that is not fiber will turn to some sugar in some way, shape, or form, and always will have some great detrimental effects, either by raising insulin, glycation, whether it turns to fructose, any carbohydrate that is not a fiber. So you can read a food label, and it'll give how many grams of carbohydrate and how many grams of fiber. You just subtract the fiber from the total carbohydrate, and then you've got the sugar-producing carbohydrates, and that will cause damage. You want to go as low as possible on that because it's a non-essential nutrient. In other words, you could live your life perfectly healthy. In fact, you might be one of the healthiest people on Earth if you never had a gram of non-fiber carbohydrate from the moment you were a fetus. There's no known biological need to eat carbohydrates. It's a non-essential nutrient. You'll never see a carbohydrate in a list of essential nutrients. And that's a big, big myth and fallacy that's generated that we have to eat carbohydrates. We don't. There's no lower limit. That's untrue with protein. That's the next major macronutrient. With protein, the critical factor there is how much. It's less critical, although there are certainly some differences among different types of protein. But the more critical factor is, first, how much. And typically, a person will need roughly 1 gram of protein per kilogram of lean body mass per day. So if you kind of estimate what your weight would be without any fat at all. So if you're an Ethiopian marathon runner, you might have 7-8% body fat, so you just take your weight minus 8% and convert it into kilograms, and that will give you your lean mass in kilograms, and you need about 1 gram of protein per kilo of lean mass per day, generally divided into 2 or 3 different meals. So for most people, what that translates to is somewhere between 50 and 60 grams of protein a day, divided, as I say, into 2 meals, and you'll also get it in snacks. So for me, for instance, I have about 2 protein meals a day. I might have a couple of eggs in the morning and maybe a piece of fish in the evening, and then I eat nuts to snack on during the day, which gives me a little bit of protein, so it'll trickle in throughout the day, and my total is roughly 50 grams.
Which isn't very much at all.
No, but we're talking about the weight of pure protein, not the weight of the let's say a piece of meat. So 75 grams of meat might have 15 to 20 grams of protein. Mostly
I got
water
you.
Weight.
So you really need to look at a calculator to see what protein, or look the package, what the protein content is. So you're not assuming it's a half a pound of steak is half a pound of protein.
Yeah.
It isn't. Okay, I got
yeah.
it.
Well, there are simple rules. Certainly, there are also many online nutritional websites that will tell you exactly how much protein, fat, and carbohydrate are in whatever meal you might plug into the program. But simple rules are that any piece of meat, including fish, about the size of a deck of cards, will contain roughly 15 grams of protein.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So,
okay.
I think, a pretty good rule of thumb that will cover most instances. And a person doesn't necessarily have to be totally 100% accurate on this, but what's critical, and the reason that for 2 decades, the only nutrient that I've had people count is protein,
mm-hmm.
is so that they avoid a high-protein diet.
Mm-hmm.
People will find it's easier said than done, because there's this innate unconscious fear that has been instilled in us in eating fat. And until people start getting comfortable with eating fat, and they'll find that it's not going to kill them, and it doesn't even make them fat, and in fact they'll lose weight by doing it, because it satiates, it controls it, it lowers leptin. And when you lower leptin, you control your brain, and your desires for carbohydrates and sweets goes way down. You basically get over the addiction, and you become satiated, and your body starts to learn how to burn fat effectively, so that when you're not eating, you're still burning fat, which means your cells are still eating fat even though you're not putting any food in your mouth. So you're still burning fat then at night, and as long as your cells are obtaining an easy fuel supply from fat that a person might have had stored for the last 40 years, you're not going to be hungry. And it's really the hunger that has to be controlled. That's really the element that will determine whether you're fat or not, ultimately, is your ability to burn fat and hunger. People get fat not because they eat it. They get fat because they can't burn it.
Right.
And that's really, really critical. And they get fat because they can't burn their fat and because they're overly hungry all the time and they eat too much. And by eating a high-fat, moderate protein like we discussed and a very low non-fiber carbohydrate diet, hunger is very much well controlled. Now, it takes 2 to 3, sometimes 4 weeks for the body to become accustomed to this. So there'll be some willpower that is necessary for the first few weeks. But I found that most people have that willpower for a few weeks. But the problem has arisen in diet that a person will start going on a yo-yo type diet where they lose weight and then they gain it all back, and they lose weight and they gain it all back. And that's because leptin's not controlled. So you try and use your willpower and go on a low-calorie diet, and you'll do it, and you'll lose weight. You might lose weight for a month or two or three, and then you'll just pig out. And you'll gain all that weight back and more because you're so hungry. You just can't control it.
Ron, let's mention the healthy oils. So people need to know
the
kind of fat.
Yeah, I was getting to that.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
we're coming to the end. They don't want to miss
protein,
this important bit.
And fat. Now, fat is 90% of nutrition, as I mentioned. And they have very different effects. And so people have heard of saturated fats, and they're afraid of saturated fats. And they shouldn't be, although saturated fats are a little bit harder to burn. And so initially I tell people that they can eat saturated fat, but perhaps not as much as other fats until a month has gone by. And they've become very accustomed to burning fat. They're good at burning fat, and then they can burn the saturated fat, and it'll burn before it gets stored. And that's an important concept, too, because there's this fear of omega-6 fatty acids and omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, and there should be, because omega-6 are pro-inflammatory. You can consider omega-6 as kind of being the counterpart to omega-3 in fish oil. So people have heard all the benefits of fish oil, and they're true. They're great. Fish oil is great for you. And omega-6s are kind of the opposite, whereas omega-3s are anti-inflammatory, omega-6s are pro-inflammatory, and that's kind of a generalization, but pretty true. However, what isn't typically realized is that your body tends to burn first what it eats. And so if you're in a good fat-burning mode, if your leptin is low, if your leptin's sensitive and you're insulin sensitive, you're gonna be more apt to burn whatever fat you eat. And then if you eat too much omega-6 fatty acids, you'll burn it. And that's a good thing. So before it can do harm, the reason it does harm is because it becomes incorporated in cell membranes and it turns into pro-inflammatory cytokines, which are kind of transient hormones.
Dr. Rosedale, that's a little message that says we've come to the end. Would you believe it? I know you're just getting going, but I want to remind everyone they can learn more about this really profound information at your site, drrosedale.com. Pick up Dr. Rosedale's book, The Rosedale Diet. And Dr. Rosedale, I wish we'll have to get you back because this is we didn't even get into the cancer component. So next time we'll do that. But thank you so much. I know you're so busy running around the world, and I appreciate your time today. It's been most enlightening.
Oh, it went by so quickly, I didn't realize that we had come to the end. Otherwise, I would have been a little bit more time conscious. So thank you very much, and I look forward to next time.
Okay, thank you so much. And to everyone listening, thank you. Remember, I'll be in New York, May 11th, Natural Gourmet Institute, and always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.